This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Iran warns against the establishment of any regional coalition with Israel, saying that will jeopardize West Asia's security and stability. The political crisis in the UK deepens, with Prime Minister Boris Johnson refusing to step down despite a growing revolt against his leadership. Plus, Russia says it has destroyed two advanced US-made HIMARS rocket systems in eastern Ukraine. Kiev rejects the claim as being fake. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour: the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council has raised the alarm about the consequences of forming any coalition with the Israeli regime. Ali Shamkhani was speaking in a meeting with the visiting Qatari Foreign Minister Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani in Tehran. The Iranian top security officials said any coalition with Tel Aviv will jeopardize West Asia's security and stability. He labeled terrorism and Zionism the main components of insecurity in the region. Shamkhani also touched upon Iran's regional strategy. He said Tehran has always sought to help preserve the territorial integrity of all countries and expand ties with its neighbors on the basis of good neighborliness. The Qatari foreign minister, for his part, called for establishing lasting peace in the region. The Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says it has identified foreign diplomats and nationals committing acts of espionage in Iran. They include a British and an Austrian diplomat, as well as a Polish national. Footage released by the IRGC shows they were spotted taking soil samples in restricted areas. One of them is Giles Whittaker, the UK deputy ambassador to Tehran. Whittaker and his family visited the central Shahdad desert as tourists, during which he was spotted collecting soil samples. Whittaker was also engaged in shooting photographs in a forbidden area. The illegal acts happened just as the IRGC aerospace forces were conducting missile exercises in the vicinity. Whittaker was asked to leave the area after apologizing for his conduct. Also among those identified is the husband of Austria's cultural attaché to Iran. and a Polish university professor. They were both caught on camera collecting samples. Iran is hosting the first edition of Tehran Investment Summit. The business event seeks to acquaint Iranian and foreign business people with investment opportunities in the Iranian capital. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Tehran, the capital of Iran, and now a destination for investors. Tehran Investment Summit brought together businesses, mayors, and urban development officials from Iran and the world to explore areas of investment in Tehran.
It's so important for us to participate in here, and we consider as a not only for a relationship between two cities, it's in the, including for the relationship between two countries.
2 years ago, the Iranian and Nicaraguan capitals, Tehran and Managua, signed an MOU that named them as sister cities. Now, with the Tehran Investment Summit, there is a chance for Managua to further cooperate with Tehran in launching urban development projects.
210 projects covering waste management, transport, and tourism, among others, will be introduced to investors in the two-day conference. The projects total roughly $71 billion. Tehran municipality says if those projects are accomplished, they will revolutionize the Iranian capital.
This is the start of a turning point in Tehran's development. This conference was inaugurated today, but it has no closing ceremony. The exhibition section of the event will continue to run permanently to highlight any area that needs investment. This will transform Tehran's future.
Being among the busiest cities means that Tehran is inevitably among the most polluted places in the world. Municipal authorities say they also welcome any investment in controlling air pollution in Tehran.
Eliminating air pollution and traffic congestions are among the major challenges in Tehran, which can be solved permanently through the promotion of clean transportation. I'm certain that many investors would love to invest in this area.
Attracting foreign investment has long been a challenge for Iran as a result of U.S. sanctions that restrict global banking transactions with Iran. Life in the Iranian capital is a mixed experience of modernity and antiquity, as it's home to both skyscrapers and historic buildings, together making it a hot tourist target. But tourism is only one of the countless capacities for investment in Tehran, as it's home to some 15 million residents, and with a large population comes a wide array of interests and businesses. As the capital of Iran, Tehran has numerous opportunities for investors, from tourism to transport and pollution control projects. Many of those projects have so far been running based on citizen participation or tax revenues. Now, Tehran municipality says with its approach shifting toward investment, the development of the metropolis is expected to accelerate. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Also, will the British Prime Minister cling on to power? Boris Johnson himself has been cold to mounting calls to resign so far, while more than 30 members of his government have resigned in under 24 hours.
It's exactly when times are tough and when the country faces pressures on the economy and pressures on their budgets, Mr. Speaker, and when we have the biggest war in Europe for 80 years, Mr. Speaker, that is exactly the moment that you'd expect a government to continue with its work, not to walk away, Mr. Speaker, and to get on with our job and to focus on the things that matter to the people of this country.
Johnson was speaking during the weekly question time debate in Parliament. He said he would resign only if he feels it's impossible for the government to go ahead. Johnson has been urged by a senior cabinet minister to resign. The community secretary, Michael Gove, says he has told the prime minister that he must go. In addition, the leader of the opposition party has also made a blistering attack on Johnson during the parliament session.
Anyone quitting now, after defending all that, hasn't got a shred of integrity. Mr. Speaker, isn't this the first recorded case of the sinking ships fleeing the rat?
Starmer said the government is showing signs of collapse given the wave of scandals and resignations which started on Tuesday. The finance minister and health secretary have already quit. They both said they could no longer tolerate the culture of scandal surrounding Johnson's tenure. The resignations came after it was revealed that Johnson had been aware of allegations of sexual misconduct by a member of parliament before hiring him as the ruling party's deputy chief whip.
What was meant to be a routine weekly gathering of cabinet ministers morphed into something very different. Double mortal blows to the Prime Minister Boris Johnson as his health secretary Sajid Javid and Chancellor Rishi Sunak quit their jobs within minutes of each other, handing in resignation letters that make for extraordinary reading. The vote of confidence last month, Sajid Javid wrote, was a moment for humility, grip, and new direction. I regret to say, however, that it is clear to me that the situation will not change under your leadership, and you have therefore lost my confidence too. The Chancellor also took aim at the PM's character. The public, he wrote, rightly expect government to be conducted properly, competently, and seriously.
Nothing's worse for a party than a loss of faith in the character of their leader. And these senior politicians, and let's recognise over a dozen of them have now resigned, are saying it's either Boris Johnson or us. Since Boris Johnson isn't going, they are. They're going to have to sit it out, like Boris, but there can only be one winner, and it won't be the Prime Minister.
Boris Johnson's is a government embroiled in sleaze and scandal for months, from lockdown rules-breaching parties under his roof to porn-watching MP. The latest controversy emerged over this man, Chris Pincher, forced to resign from government over accusations of sexual harassment. But the last straw was when it turned out that despite Number 10's denials, the Prime Minister knew of a past formal complaint against Pincher all along. He appointed him to his cabinet.
I apologise for it. I think in hindsight it was the wrong thing to do. I apologise to everybody who's been badly affected by it.
But that didn't wash with the now former Chancellor and Health Secretary or the dozens of MPs who have already resigned. More defections could be on the way.
There's no doubt that we will see more resignations, with quite a few cabinet ministers not declaring one way or the other. But the realpolitik here is he's lost the confidence of his party. He's lost the confidence of a very large number of people whom he himself appointed, and the public aren't taking him seriously. I like Boris as a friend. I think he's a decent man. But the one thing he doesn't seem to have is good judgment about when to leave.
Whether or not Boris Johnson can survive politically is a question debated by his friends and foes for months. The question now is whether these recent resignations will be the beginning of the end for a prime minister whose leadership is in freefall and as the specter of a new no-confidence vote looms large. Saipur is up, London.
The UK has finally decided to extradite WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to the US to face trial on publishing classified military documents despite criticism. There is one world leader that has come out in his defense, Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador. He says if Assange is extradited and charged in the US, then the Statue of Liberty, which stands for freedom, should be dismantled.
The Mexican president has criticized the United States over the possible extradition of WikiLeaks whistleblower to Washington. Andrés Manuel López Obrador has suggested that Statue of Liberty be taken down if Julian Assange is sent from Britain to the U.S. Obrador said at a press conference that the Statue of Liberty in New York Harbor in New York City in the United States ought to be dismantled if a U.S. court indicts Assange. If he is brought to the U.S. and sentenced to the maximum penalty, to death in prison, it will be necessary to start a campaign to dismantle the Statue of Liberty in New York, donated by the French, because it will no longer be a symbol of freedom.
You can't go around, as the United States does, proclaiming yourself the judge of freedom and democracy and the representative of freedom and democracy, and, you know, be giving awards around the world for freedom of press and freedom of speech when you're engaged in the most dangerous prosecution of a journalist in modern era.
The Mexican president, who is scheduled to visit the United States for talks with U.S. President Joe Biden in Washington next week, said he would bring up the issue of Assange's extradition in the meeting with his American counterpart. In January 2022, López Obrador said that he would be willing to offer political asylum in Mexico to Assange.
I mean, you know, this is a terrible, dangerous action that the United States has taken against Julian Assange. This is a guy who's published the same things that the New York Times, in cooperation with the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Guardian and the major papers around the world, he did nothing different than they did. He got information from a source, which was true, and he published it. And it's so dangerous. Now he's been in custody for 10 years.
López Obrador was invited to Washington after announcing that he was not going to participate in the Americas summit organized by the Biden government at the beginning of last month in protest over the fact that Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela, Miguel Díaz-Canel of Cuba, and Daniel Ortega of Nicaragua were not invited.
The Mexican president's stance on Assange is shared by Assange's supporters. They feel Assange should not be prosecuted since he exposed U.S. crimes during its war on Afghanistan and Iraq. Obrador and Assange's supporters feel that his prosecution is a politically motivated assault on journalism and free speech. There are many who also believe that U.S. authorities should actually be put on trial for atrocities committed by American forces.
The U.S. government has filed criminal charges against Assange for publishing about 750,000 classified military and diplomatic documents related to the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Washington claims releasing vast troves of confidential U.S. military records and diplomatic cables has put American agents' lives in danger. Since the beginning of his political activism, Assange has been praised as an anti-establishment hero who has exposed U.S. atrocities in conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq.
So the United States is exerting extraterritorial jurisdiction over journalists who tell the truth that is embarrassing to the United States. And they want to bring him here and put him in jail for 175 years.
Supporters of Assange accused the United States and Britain of victimizing him and decried the criminal charges as a politically motivated attack on journalism and free speech. Australian-born Assange has lodged an appeal with the United Kingdom's High Court against his extradition to the United States. Assange, who is wanted by U.S. authorities on 18 counts, will be extradited within 28 days if his appeal is rejected by the High Court. Assange had spent 7 years at the Ecuadorian embassy in London before his arrest by UK Metropolitan Police in April after the Ecuadorian government cancelled his asylum.
Turning elsewhere now, Russia says its troops have destroyed two advanced U.S.-made HIMARS rocket systems and their ammunition depots in eastern Ukraine. A Russian Defense Ministry said the operation destroyed two launchers for HIMARS rockets that the U.S. and its allies had supplied to Kiev. Ukraine's general staff has rejected Moscow's claims as fake, saying it is using the rocket system to hit Russian forces' positions. The U.S. has so far delivered 4 units of the rocket system to Ukraine. Washington has pledged to deliver a total of 8 rocket systems to Kiev by the middle of this month. That's despite warnings from Russia that Western weapons supply to Ukraine will only fan the flames of the war. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Martyrdom of Imam Baqir, peace upon him, on the eve of Hajj. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam, dear listeners. We offer you our heartfelt condolences on the anniversary of a very tragic day that coincides every year with commencement of the Hajj pilgrimage in Mecca and on the threshold of Eid al-Adha. The 7th of Dhul-Hajjah is indeed a doleful day, as is evident by our commemoration of the martyrdom of an infallible member of the Prophet of Islam's blessed household, who directed the minds of Muslims towards the great injustice done to the Ahl al-Bayt by depriving them of their right of political leadership. He said, "There is no single Eid al-Fitr or Eid al-Adha in which Muslims do not renew their sorrows for the progeny of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, because they see their Ahl al-Bayt's rights in the hands of others." As is clear by the wordings, he was lamenting the usurpation of the God-given religious, social, and political rights of the Ahl al-Bayt, or progeny of Allah's last and greatest messenger by godless persons who masqueraded as caliphs or rulers of the Islamic realm and who continue to confound the faith of the Ummah through acts of terrorism in order to tarnish the image of Muslims. Stay with us for an exclusive feature on Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, the fifth infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Imam Baqir, peace upon him, needs no introduction. Born in 57 AH in Medina, he was descended on both sides from the seal of messengers. If his mother, Fatima, was the daughter of the Prophet's elder grandson, Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace upon him, his father, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, was the son and successor of the Prophet's younger grandson, the martyr of Karbala, Imam Hussein, peace upon him. In turn, Imam Baqir, peace upon him, was the father of Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, the reviver of the Prophet's genuine Sharia, which is famous as Ja'fari jurisprudence, and which, in stark contrast to the violence of the Wahhabis, the sedition of the Salafis, and terrorism of the Takfiris and other pseudo-Muslim outfits, is the most humanitarian code of conduct. Even his own epithet, Baqir al-Ulum, or the splitter and the spreader of sciences, was prophesied by the Prophet, who also conveyed his salam, or greetings, to his great-great-grandson through the loyal companion, Jabir ibn Abdullah Ansari, 5 decades before his birth. Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, was hardly 4 years old when he had to witness the heart-rending tragedy on the plain of Karbala, where besides his grandfather and granduncles such as Hazrat Abbas and others, his own paternal and maternal uncles were brutally martyred by the godless Umayyad forces, that is, Ali Akbar, and the six-month infant Ali Asghar on his father's side and Qasim and Abdullah on his mother's side. The tragedy did not end on the equally tragic evening of Ashura, when the encampment of the Ahlul Bayt was burnt by the heartless hordes who severed the heads of the martyrs and trampled their bodies. The next day, the noble ladies and children of the Prophet's household were paraded as prisoners in the streets of Kufa and mocked in the court of the tyrannical governor, Ubaidullah ibn Ziyad, before being forced marched through circuitous routes all the way to distant Damascus in Syria, where the self-styled caliph Yazid ibn Muawiyah burst into unbounded joy, saying he has avenged the deaths of his infidel ancestors who had fallen in battle against the Prophet of Islam at Badr and Uhud. Then, in confrontation of his own atheism, Yazid added, "The Hashemites had played the game of kingdom. There was neither any prophet nor any revelation from heaven." Yazid, stunned by the bold remarks of Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, in defense of the rights of the Ahlul Bayt and the virtues of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, threatened to kill the fourth Imam as his courtiers watched in mute silence. At this moment, the four-year-old boy, Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, sprang to the defense of his father, and to the astonishment of the whole court, spoke in flawlessly fluent Arabic by pointing the glaring difference between Yazid's court and the court of the Egyptian pharaoh, although both were tyrants. When asked about the difference, the boy replied that the reason the Pharaoh and his courtiers did not call for the execution of Prophet Moses proves there was no illegitimately born person amongst them, while Yazid's threats to kill the Prophet of Islam's rightful heir and the silence of the onlookers is proof of the illegitimacy of the whole court. For the next 34 years, Imam Baqir, peace upon him, grew up in the shadow of his illustrious father, safeguarding the genuine Muhammadan legacy of Islam while a string of usurpers rose and fell, fighting each other for power of the state, such as the charlatan Abdullah ibn Zubayr, who during his 10-year rule in Hejaz violated the letter and the spirit of the noble Quran through mismanagement of the Hajj, and the oppression of the Prophet's household, including a failed plot to burn alive all male members of the Hashemite clan, similar to what the Saudi usurpers do today. In 95 AH, Imam Baqir, peace upon him, formally assumed the divine trust of Imamat and continued his father's mission by expounding to the seekers of truth various issues such as exegesis of the ayahs of the Noble Quran, the accounts of the prophets of the past, the nature of the material world, the delicateness of nafs or the human soul, and how it should be safeguarded from deviation and pollution. During the 19 years that he was the representative of God upon earth, he spared no efforts to guide Muslims, even advising the regime to mint currency of its own instead of importing coins from the Roman Emperor. In his era, five more Umayyad usurpers masqueraded as caliphs, the last of whom was the tyrant Hisham ibn Abdul Malik, whose prejudice against non-Arab Muslims caused him to double the taxes that they had to pay. Hisham, jealous of the Prophet's pure progeny, wrote to his governor of Medina, instructing him to send Imam Baqir, peace upon him, and his son, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, to Damascus, intending to humiliate them in front of an audience. When they reached Damascus, he kept them waiting for 3 days. On the fourth day, he called them in his presence. He sat on a throne, surrounded by his armed guards. In the center of the courtyard, a target was set on which marksmen were shooting arrows. Hisham asked Imam Baqir, peace upon him, to shoot some arrows at the target, thinking that the Imam had no experience in martial arts. Imam Baqir, peace upon him, said he should be excused. But Hisham kept insisting as he planned to ridicule the Imam. He did not know that each infallible heir of the Prophet was inheritor of the virtues of their ancestors, including the martial expertise of the commander of the faithful Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him. Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, reluctantly took the bow. And to the astonishment of Hisham and the marksmen, he shot a few arrows continuously, each piercing the other on the very center spot of the target. Hisham, outwitted, began to discuss the problems of the Imamat and the virtues of the Ahlul Bayt. And when Imam Baqir, peace upon him, recounted these God-given merits on the basis of the Noble Quran and the Prophet's Hadith, he clearly saw the stay of the Imam in Damascus might lead to popular respect for the Ahlul Bayt. So he sent Imam Baqir, peace upon him, to Medina, especially after the debate the Prophet's heir had with the chief Christian monk of Syria, who became Muslim along with his followers. The criminal Hisham now plotted the murder of the Prophet's 15th infallible heir by sending him a poison-laced saddle. The poison was applied most skillfully, and when Imam Baqir, peace upon him, mounted the poison, affected his whole body. As a result, Imam Baqir, peace upon him, was afflicted, couldn't perform that year's Hajj due to sickness, and finally left for his heavenly abode at the age of 57, but not before making a will to keep alive the legacy of the Ahlul Bayt. Part of the will read that a sum of 800 dirhams be allotted to hold mourning ceremonies at Mina during the climax of the Hajj for 10 years, so that pilgrims coming from all over the Muslim world become familiar with the merits of the Prophet's Ahlul Bayt and their sufferings at the hands of the usurpers of the Caliphate. After a few days in pain, the Imam attained martyrdom on 7th of Dhul-Hajjah, 114 AH, and was laid to rest in Jannatul Baqi Cemetery beside his father, Imam Zainul Abidin, and maternal grandfather, Imam Hasan Mujtaba, peace upon them. Since we are on the eve of the annual Hajj pilgrimage, here is an account of Imam Baqir, peace upon him, according to a person named Aflah, whom the fifth Imam had bought from an Arab and freed from enslavement, was accompanying Imam Baqir, peace upon him, during the Hajj pilgrimage, when on entering the Masjid al-Haram and sighting the Holy Kaaba, he started weeping incessantly. I said, "My parents be sacrificed for you. People are watching you. Can you not lower your voice to a whisper?" The Imam answered, "O Aflah, this is the house of Allah. Why should I not weep? I will certainly be of esteem in His sight and attain salvation in the hereafter." Aflah says the Imam then circumambulated the Holy Kaaba, performed the special prayer for Tawaf in its proper place, and fell into prostration. When he raised his head, his forehead was wet with tears. Before we bid farewell to you, here is a famous saying of the fifth Imam on one of the rituals of the Hajj. "The supplications of every pious or impious person who stays in Arafat and in Mash'ar al-Haram the following night will definitely be answered by God. The supplications of a pious person will be fulfilled in matters regarding both this world and afterlife, but the supplications of an impious person will be fulfilled only in matters regarding this transient world."
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
Iran and Yemen.
Part 1.
Saturday, September 14th, 2019, Eastern Saudi Arabia, where Aramco oil facilities are located. Blast and massive fire were the headlines news for the media. From the very first moments the news was spread, it was clear that the explosion wasn't due to a technical problem. Saudi Arabia was attacked. Saudi Arabia, with its production of 9.8 million barrels of oil per day, is the biggest oil producer in the world. But after the attack, its production was reduced to 4.1 million barrels. It means 5% of the daily oil production in the world. The markets opened after the weekend holidays on Monday, and the cost of Brent oil shot up by 20%. The world was experiencing a major oil shock. In all these years, protecting Saudi oil reserves was considered protecting a major part of the West's energy resources. That's why Saudi Arabia has purchased a well-equipped army armed to the teeth with the most advanced U.S. weapons. But a few hours later, a Yemeni group claimed responsibility for the attack. Group is known as Houthi Ansarullah. During these years, we've heard the names Ansarullah and Yemen many times. But do we really know anything of what's going on in Yemen? Especially now that Iran has been mentioned among supporters of Ansarullah and the uprising in Yemen. Even after a large-scale drone attack on Saudi Aramco oil facilities, the West did not want to accept that it was the Yemenis who launched such a massive attack, so they pointed the finger at Iran. But it wasn't the beginning of the story. The story had begun much earlier. Most of us are not aware of Iran's old relationship with Yemen and the Yemeni people. In fact, the relationship dates back to the Sassanid era, around 535 AD, when Shirvan was in power. Ethiopia attacked Yemen and occupied the country. Someone from Yemen went to Anushirvan's palace and asked for help in the face of the Ethiopian Christians' oppression in Yemen, and asked the king to help his people. But the incident had an international aspect as well. To understand what was going on, we need an ancient map. Iran and ancient Rome were fighting with each other most of the time. Romans were Christians, Ethiopia was a Christian nation, so it was a natural ally of the Romans. But now, look at this part. This is India's shores, from where different goods are exported. It's directly linked with the Red Sea through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, southern Yemen. You can move up north and reach Egypt, that was captured by the Romans. Egypt was en route to Ethiopia and Rome. This is the map for the allied Christian countries throughout the 5th and 6th centuries. Iran was the only force that resisted against the Union, and Yemen was a vital trade chokehold for the Christian alliance. So, I guess you've realized what Ethiopia was pursuing by attacking Yemen, securing the trade route between India and the Christian world. There are also religious incentives at work, spreading Christianity to the heart of Saudi Arabia and hence making the southern Iranian borders insecure. Anushirvan for the first time noticed the danger that Yemeni invasion posed against Iran. And though domestic problems held him back for a while, when the Yemeni envoy came to him and asked for help, the Iranians were ethically bound to help the people who sought it. But before that, a new war broke out, this time around a war from the east. In the year 557 AD, Anushirvan fought a war with the Heftalites in today's Uzbekistan. He captured the land on the side of the Amudarya and brought the Silk Road under Iran's control. The Silk Road was captured because the goods exported from China to the West passed through this route. By capturing the Silk Road, Anushirvan levied a heavy tariff on Chinese goods. It was an economic strategy so Roman tradesmen would buy Chinese silk at a higher price and send more gold to the Iranian coffers. After the achievement, Anushirvan decided to do the same with Indian goods. This was a route the Indian goods pass. Yemen, the Bubble Mandab Strait, this is a place the Ethiopia-Rome Christian unity had occupied. The drums of war were beaten. 8 warships sailed to Yemen. Anushirvan's forces secretly allied with the Arab tribes in Yemen against the Christian occupiers. The Arab tribes formed the Iranian army's ground forces. In the old narratives, it is mentioned that the Iranian army commander, Vahriz, was an old archer and targeted the Ethiopian army's commander with only one arrow. The arrow turned the tide in the war in favor of Iran and Yemen. We're in Sana'a, in the old section of the city called Old City. UNESCO has put it on the list of World Heritage Sites. In the recent war, Saudi airstrikes have demolished parts of the ancient city, but you can still see images of ancient world in the ruins of the city. Gate known as Bab al-Yaman or Yemen's Gate is over 1,000 years old. The United Iranian Army and Yemeni forces who defeated Ethiopian Christians triumphantly passed through this gate. By capturing Yemen, Khosrow Anushirvan practically put a chokehold on Rome's economy. This city, Sana'a, Yemen's capital, became one of Iran's provinces for 60 years. Iranians in Yemen were the first Iranians who converted to Islam. after the Prophet's invitation, the Iranians even received Islam with open arms and without a war. There are many old stories about Iranian presence in Yemen in the old days, but most of us are not aware of Iran's old relationship with Yemen and the Yemeni people. Now we fast forward in history and reach the era when Anushirvan and the Sassanids did not exist any longer. Iran's interests have also changed. Iran, as an Islamic country, isn't after military expansionism, but after friendship with Islamic countries. But the friendship has its own hardships as well. Yemen is an old land that has been mentioned in old Greek books and the Holy Book. Romans call it Happy Arabia. The reason for the name was the seasonal rains that made it green and filled with water, as opposed to Saudi Arabia. In old myths, a large dam has been mentioned that kept a huge amount of water reserves for agriculture in Yemen, but the dam broke and Yemen was flooded. The flood turned Yemen into ruins. Centuries have passed since the golden Yemeni buildings with special architecture are now covered with the dust of history. In the new era, the colonial powers' ships have docked in Yemen's ports. During the colonial era, Britain noticed the significance of the Bab el-Mandab Strait and took control of Yemen. Different forces fought the colonial British troops. One of them was the Zaydis. One of their fighters was Imam Yahya, one of the leaders of the Zaydis in Yemen. Imam Yahya took power after Yemen gained independence. He was an interesting character. His British enemies and Zaydi followers, and even the Jewish minority in the country who was supported by him, all praised him. This building was his residence in Sana'a. Sana'a was the capital during his ruling. During the First and Second World Wars, it was an independent country named North Yemen. Now this is Sana'a's Grand Mosque, the oldest mosque in Yemen that dates back to the time when the Prophet was alive. But archaeologists say the current buildings date back Bani Umayyah. We can see the typical features of an old mosque in Yemen, the same windows, the same brick walls, the same battlements, and the same light color that has created additional lines in the heart of the gray color, and you could see it only in Yemen. In 1973, ancient copies of the Quran that were transcribed in ancient Yemeni calligraphy were discovered at the heart of this very mosque. The copies of the Quran were from the 1st century AH. They were probably transcribed by Imam Ali, peace be upon him. All this means Sana'a, and hence North Yemen, was ancient. It's always been more significant. South Yemen, whose capital was Aden, has been mostly tied to the modern era. South Yemen stretches from the Bab al-Mandab Strait to Oman's border and was still controlled by Britain when North Yemen gained independence from the Ottoman Empire. North Yemen was controlled by followers of the Zaydis. So who were the followers of the Zaydis? The story of the Zaydis' leadership starts from Iraq in the old days during the Bani Umayya era. Zayd was the son of the fourth Shia Imam, Zayn al-Abidin, peace be upon him, and the grandson of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. He always wanted to fight with Bani Umayya as ruling. During Hisham ibn Abd al-Malik's caliphate, he got the chance and moved to Kufa for an uprising. It was the headquarters of the Shias in Iraq. But Zayd's uprising was quickly defeated. The government suppressed the Shia dissidents mercilessly. Zayd was killed during the first moments of the uprising, and his son Yahya fled to Iran after living in a hideout for a while. Yahya's presence in Iran was one of the reasons for the expansion of Shiism in Iran. A few years later, Siyah Jamegan, Men in Black, rose up to seek revenge for Yahya's blood. Even though the end of the uprising, Bani Abbas took power, at least Bani Umayya, that was a very tribe-oriented ruling, was toppled. These were only the political consequences of Zayd's uprising. Many people believed in Zayd's spiritual leadership, so a new branch named Zaydi Shiism was formed. In the northern Iranian city of Amul, there is a mausoleum that shows the footprints of the political movement of Zaydi Shias in Iran. Nasser al-Haq was one of Zayd's grandchildren. Many Zoroastrians in Gilan and Mazandaran provinces converted to Islam because of him and fought with suppressive governments outside Mazandaran and Gilan. Nasser al-Haq's uprising was defeated, but Zayd's grandchildren in Mazandaran and Gilan ruled for a long time. It might be hard to believe, but even the current Iranian capital, Tehran, was ruled by Zayd's dissidents for a while. Zaydi movement in Iran became powerful and credible for a while, but the movement was more widespread in Yemen. The Zaydi imams in Yemen started their activities in 284 AH. It was exactly the time when the Zaydi movement was at its peak in Gilan and Mazandaran provinces. As opposed to Iran, the Zaydi dynasty lived on in Yemen from 284 AH to World War I and Imam Yahya's ruling. 65 Zaydi imams were in power in Yemen.
in the limelight.
Britain's Labour leader Keir Starmer says he will rebuild trust with the European Union on key areas of disagreement, such as the Northern Ireland Protocol, and get a better deal for the British people. We now present you an article written by Peter Walker. The piece is titled Starmer Ends Labour Silence on Brexit as he rules out rejoining single market. Keir Starmer has thrown the Labour Party back into the Brexit debate by ruling out any return to the single market or customs union, but arguing he could remove trade and travel barriers as Prime Minister because the European Union would trust him. In a speech on Monday evening, 4th of July, that ended Labour's habitual silence on the subject since the referendum, Keir Starmer pledged to tackle what he called a fatberg of red tape and bureaucracy caused by Boris Johnson's Brexit deal. Starmer cast himself as an honest broker, able to reach better compromises on key areas of disagreement with the European Union, such as the Northern Ireland Protocol.